So I've got Tony Gosling on the line, a great guy. He's a guy. Tony's pronouns are the man, right? So I could put Tony into my new phone, but I could choose non-binary alongside his name if I want. Apple is very good. Tony Gosling is a decorated journalist and author, the presenter of the Not the BCFM radio show every Friday at 5 o'clock from Bristol. We'll let you know where you can get it later on. I know you know it anyway. Let's welcome back to the programme he, she, them, Tony Gosling. How are you? Did you realise that? Did you realise that? If you've got an iPhone, it now allows you to add somebody's pronouns and you create a contact. Very important that, isn't it? Hugely important.
Well, I am definitely binary.
You're binary. There's no two ways.
For the Apple.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating day with this guy. I mean, I've spent much of my journalistic career tracking Mr. Kissinger and his various exploits. And also, of course, when I first started in the 1980s, tracking back what he'd been up to previously. I've sent you, I don't know if you're able to share it with your listeners, a sort of basic timeline of Kissinger, because he started very early on and it was pretty much as soon as he appeared on the scene as an author that he was also starting to attend the Bilderberg conferences in the late 1950s, Richie.
Now, let's just remind our listeners before you take us through the weird and not so wonderful tale of Henry Kissinger. It was announced this morning, dear listener, that Henry Kissinger, former US Secretary of State, the BBC says, a man who played a pivotal and polarizing role in US foreign policy during the Cold War has died at the age of 100. He was America's top diplomat and national security advisor during Nixon and Ford administrations. And the thing about you, Tony, I know that you've even come across this guy because you've covered Bilderberg on the ground for years, so you've been within meters of the guy. I know you've attempted to doorstep the guy. I know you've followed him around for years. People don't know very much about him, and they don't know that right up until he died today, this guy was still meddling, or meddling is not putting it strongly enough, was still incredibly influential in terms of Western politics and Western political policies, wasn't he? But he's dead now. Go back to the beginning then. Who is this guy? Where did he come from?
Well, he was a German. His real name's Heinz. He had a very strong, pronounced German accent for many years, which he tried to get rid of. But, I mean, just trying to look at his position in history, he's a kind of Albert Pike, John Dee, Licio Gelli, one of these big operators behind the scenes. The sort of person that is, I mean, one of the things that you could always tell with Kissinger in, certainly during my time in journalism, was the ridiculous deference that the mass media paid to him. He's like a god. I mean, you know, they would probably refer to him as a sort of king of the deep state or something, quietly. But, you know, obviously not to the viewers and listeners, but that's the sort of character he was. And he had this amazing ability to be respected by everybody, but not necessarily because he was doing the right thing, but because I think they feared him. You know, they fear this guy is so powerful that, you know, we just have to simply, and the other thing it betrays is the way the journalists are actually maneuvered and manipulated by the managers and the editors in these media corporations to say, oh, well, you know, make sure you treat Henry Kissinger with respect. One person that didn't, just as a little anecdote, I was listening to Radio 4 when Jeremy Paxman used to do Start the Week back, I think it would be in the late 1990s, maybe early noughties, probably late 1990s, to hear Jeremy Paxman doing a very good job, actually, in quizzing him. Asking him about his war crimes, particularly in Chile and Cambodia. I mean, there's many of them, but he just picked on those two. And he started quizzing Kissinger about these things. And Henry actually got up and walked out of the live Radio 4 studio because he just doesn't want to talk about these things. Now, that's the reason is because they are war crimes. And it's worth saying that in 2001, just the day before the September the 11th attacks, in Chile, they, which had got rid of the previous fascist government of Pinochet, which Kissinger helped install. In fact, I would suggest Kissinger did install that government through his coup. The Chilean government issued an arrest warrant for Henry Kissinger. And the next day, 9/11 happened. And I remember saying, this sounds so weird, but flippantly, that night, the night before 9/11, oh, there was Kissinger's going to have to start World War III now to distract our attention. And of course, the next day we had 9/11. I was a little bit gobsmacked. But also the next year, the British also in Britain, the London lawyers attempted to get an arrest warrant for him. So he's an extremely controversial figure, even though he is most definitely a war criminal. Probably at least, well, I would say at least the very minimum, 3 million people died through the various coups and wars that he instigated.
Now, can you explain for our listeners how this is possible? I want to frame this around. If Henry Kissinger is appointed as the Secretary of State, which is effectively the Foreign Secretary, isn't he only the arm of, or isn't he only an extension of the President's cabinet? So isn't he doing only that which he is told to do? So you talked about Chile in the 70s and other things that you say he was directly responsible for. Lay it out for our listeners how it's a bit more complicated than that and how he may have been acting of his own volition, or at least acting with other actors maybe outside of his own government.
Well, of course, he's part of the permanent government. He was a national security advisor in the run-up. Now, I mean, as he got started with this book, it was a book about nuclear war, surviving a nuclear war. And actually, it was all about, this is 1957. So he'd worked his way into the deep state as an advisor. So he was, you know, he wasn't going to be elected or de-elected or anything like that. For example, when there was a rapprochement between China and the United States, back in 1971, I think it was 1972. This is something which Kissinger had arranged basically on his own. And then once he'd got it sorted out, all the cameras were switched on and President Nixon had his first visit over to China. The main purpose of all of that was, and it was successful, was to pivot the Chinese to be anti-Russian, or anti-Soviet as they were at the time, so anti-communist. And that was a great success of Kissinger. He was seen to be the one that could manage to do these things. But that's, I think, because he was in touch with the deep state within all these various countries. And he's somebody who I think his the legacy with the China relationship, for example, carries on to this day. When you see something like the COVID being cooked up in a lab, or at least released in a lab in Wuhan in China, with the Chinese and the Americans at the very top level cooperating, pretending in a way to have these trade wars and stuff. But on the very top level, when it comes to making war and releasing deadly viruses around the world, they're working together. So that's, I think, how he manages to work. You're right. He wasn't supposed to be the guy who was in charge, but Nixon was out of his depth. As happens many times, you get a president with advisors around them that are far more in the know than the president. So the president, for example, in the China situation, said, right, Henry, just go and get on with it.
And you said that Kissinger wanted to pivot the Chinese against the Russians. But it's funny to hear you say that, because this afternoon on the UK news channels, they're crediting Kissinger with normalizing relations with Russia. So what was he doing? He was playing double agent, was he? With Russia?
Oh, look, I mean, listen, there's always a bit of a double game. He successfully did pivot Mao. Again, you know, there was much more cooperation with the Americans, and the Americans withdrawing quite a lot of troops from Taiwan. And so they decided that the Chinese, that let's open trade relations with the Americans. And they started to, and there'd been a breakout of hostilities on the Chinese Soviet border. So, it was a very successful maneuver. Maybe that was organized. But I always remember being asked to do a talk about Bilderberg once years ago up in Strathclyde University. And one of the students asked me about it. I said, well, actually, it's like this guy runs the biggest protection racket on Earth. Anybody that doesn't go along with the deep state's plans, that is to say, really, the New World Order, the New World America plans, then they get a threatening letter or maybe a bullet in the head. And in fact, what that really means is mercenaries will turn up on the ground, the jackals, and start basically destroying their ability to run the country. You know, everybody likes the peace because that enables the tax to be collected. Everybody's kind of happy. But as soon as you've got mercenaries blowing things up here and there and everywhere, I believe Kissinger was one of those people that used to do that. I mean, he certainly was in places like Indonesia and Chile on a massive scale. Then your economy is disrupted. And so that's the power that Kissinger had during his time, is he could topple your economy. He could make your economy scream. This is a famous phrase of the people of, the American State Department of the Chile coup era. And they feared him, basically. But he managed on the world stage to appear to be the peacemaker. He was very much a two-faced character. And I mean, towards the end, it's been amazing to see him actually, you know, saying, look, let's stop this war in Ukraine. Maybe things have just moved beyond him. And I think this is a good way for him to have gone out, really, saying, look, let's just stop this because the Russians are not going anywhere. Ukrainians are not going anywhere. Let's just redraw the boundary and have a peace settlement in Ukraine.
Yeah, he was heavily criticized by the Ukrainians, wasn't he, for saying that, because the Ukrainians said, well, what Kissinger wants is for us to give up some territory. Kissinger said, yeah, absolutely, it's going to have to happen. There's going to have to be peace. Not to be remotely silly about this, but you describing Kissinger, and you and I, we've known each other for yonks now, and we've talked about Kissinger in the past. He reminds me, and I wonder if the character, Peter Baelish, Lord Baelish, known as Littlefinger in Game of Thrones, who's a master manipulator of people and starts wars and, you know, always to kind of better his own situation. From the Game of Thrones, he sounds very much like him. Kissinger, in terms of he was able to do that. He was able to operate seemingly as a confidant and as a peace broker and as somebody working for the greater good, but in fact he wasn't. Game of Thrones fans will know who Peter Baelish is, but it sounds very much like that character. And I remember asking you years ago about him and Bilderberg, and you said to me, Richie, he's still turning up. Not only is he turning up, but he's still hugely involved in the Bilderberg meetings year in, year out, where quite often you said to me that the agenda for the next year or two is kind of given to the attendees, maybe by people like Kissinger himself. And was Bilderberg his brainchild, was it? Was he the guy who came up with the idea?
No, I don't think it was directly his, but once it had started in 1957, he realised this was where he was going. I mean, he attended... most of the conferences since 57. He's been there, with the most regular attendee of anybody at these Bilderberg meetings, which is essentially a US CIA-led plot to bring about a one state in Europe, a kind of United States of Europe. And that's, I mean, there's all sorts of other aspects to the Bilderbergs, particularly, you know, neutralizing individual nations and letting big corporations take over and banks and things. And also, of course, all the geopolitical wars and things around that. So, when it comes to the relationship with, I think the actual facts around, you know, what he was up to, we can speculate about, you know, what kind of guy he was, but, you know, the only people who've really, really managed to drill down into exactly what he said and what he did and what influence he had and prove that he did have a massive amount of influence behind the scenes with covert operations, secret assassination squads, secret bombing of Cambodia. This all came out, but it was actually Julian Assange, when he was still running WikiLeaks, that released the Kissinger cables back in 2013. And he did a really, really good job.
What did they say, Tony?
Sorry?
Remind our listeners, what did the Kissinger cables reveal at the time?
Well, the cables showed us, for example, Kissinger was secretly, what it enabled us to do, and that's punters and journalists, is to go through and look at specific topics and get all of the Kissinger cables that related to that country or whatever, all popping up on the screen in date order at the same time. They did a fantastic job. And WikiLeaks worked with 20 different big media companies from around the world, including the big wire services like the Associated Press. And so it was possible to piece together Kissinger's influence over these events, which was damning. I mean, for example, he was the first senior person in the National Security Council in the States, obviously as Secretary of State, who was secretly commissioning wiretaps of politicians and newspaper editors. And you could see how this was anybody that was basically onto him in organizing these war criminal secret coups against other countries. He was commissioning the secret state, the CIA, basically, and the NSA to tap the phones of all these people and to go into their mail and all that sort of thing. So what you've got is this is really, in a way, the beginning of the massive, powerful deep state that we can see today being implemented as a kind of technocracy, where the journalists and the politicians are on the back foot the whole time because they're having their mail read, their houses bugged, their phones bugged, then black operations conducted against them. And I think this is one of the most important things that Julian and WikiLeaks revealed was just how key Kissinger was in this change around in policy after World War II, from the United States being this sort of trusted superpower, you know, maybe in the, well, I mean, obviously with Vietnam and Korea it wasn't, but, you know, that seen as a power that could be relied on and trusted. Suddenly it's actually, no, this is becoming a fascist country, a dictatorship where the big companies and the deep state are actually, they've constantly got the press and the politicians on the back foot, and anybody that speaks up for humanity is going to get taken out.
And the Cold War was a way of keeping people in line, wasn't it? It was a way of keeping people in fear. We learned years later, didn't we, that much of what various US defense secretaries were saying in the 70s, particularly in the 60s and 70s, about Russian capability was nothing short of a lie, just a flat out lie that the Russians had all of this technology and that they could destroy the United States and we have to have this arms race. All of this was to keep people, you know, in fear while they did this. And if you were to describe, you've already kind of done it, but if Kissinger had, as an individual, if he had a desired outcome, if there was a world he wanted to create, what would it look like? What sort of society globally was Kissinger invested in bringing into being? What was he all about, really?
Yeah, well, look, he was a one world government man. He was a globalist. He believed that you had to have one. You know, he wasn't a big fan of the United Nations because even to this day, it still represents all the different countries. There are people there on the General Assembly that will speak up against any kind of, you know, implementation of a world government. But he was definitely into that. That's, you know, almost taken as read with Kissinger, is that, you know, this was his major, in a way, his major thing. Was just trying to make sure that, I mean, he's famously, when it comes to the EU, he was very much involved in, as I said, getting the EU together. There's a fantastic quote from Kissinger about he wanted to just be able to dial one number to talk to Europe.
Yeah.
And will people please do that? I mean, he's denied that he ever said that, but he was quoted for something like 10 or 15 years as saying it before he actually denied it. So maybe he actually really did say that.
So what happened, Tony? Tony, this is important. Sorry to interrupt that. Stay with this. What happened to Kissinger then? Because he fled the Nazis and ended up in the United States Army. He actually left Germany. He escaped out of Germany, ended up in the United States Army, became a captain, and then went back to Germany. Now, somebody who saw what happened in Germany, why would that guy be in favour of imposing that on the rest of the world? That's the thing I suppose most people will be asking. Was he, this is going to sound very tabloidy, but was he just evil, the guy? Was there something wrong with him?
Well, I think there was, but not in that way. I mean, what Henry, if he was still with us, would say is that he's fed up with all of these wars, you know, and the various conflicts between these big superpowers. And that the only way you can do that is to have a powerful world government to bang heads together and to have, you know, all these other institutions like the World Health Organization were very important to him because they started to get national politicians into the mindset of thinking globally. And he believed that this was a way of stopping wars. Now, I don't, you know, I don't necessarily think that. I think there's a deliberate attempt to actually get these wars going. And to have a centralized power right now, I mean, all you need to do is look at the sort of people who would be running it all to see that it would be basically the enslavement of humanity.
You said he was fed up of war. This is interesting. You said he was fed up of war. So it sounds like the guy had the philosophy that you need to break a few eggs to make an omelet. You know, because
that's what he said.
Yeah, because but let me stay with this because hang on.
War as a way to stop war.
Yeah, but yet he waged
a bit of a misnomer,
right.
Isn't
yes, yeah, that's the point I wanted to make. Yeah, so he, you know, was behind the imposition of coups in Central Latin America and other places. Lots of people died. People were tortured. People were disappeared. You talked about Chile earlier on, and he thought, well, it's worth it if we get to a place where, you know, we don't have any of this anymore. So it sounds very warped. So was he used then? Was Kissinger just another pawn, even if a very big pawn, a serious pawn?
No, he wasn't a pawn. He was definitely a mover and shaker. But he, I mean, when his actual power in the United States in the government was mainly between 1969 and 77. And that was when he was ran the National Security Council, and then he became Secretary of State under Nixon. But there was another really important thing that happened just after that, which was in 1971. This is all during the Vietnam War. And Kissinger was one of the main actual pushers of the Vietnam War. That was the most obviously a hideous conflict. Hundreds of thousands of innocent people died. It was really, if you want to step back from Vietnam, it was part of the United States after World War II replacing the old French colonial, it was mainly French colonies around there, at control of the drugs trade. So at the end of the Vietnam War, the Americans have pretty much wrested control of, you know, opium production and whatever. So, you know, there's, for those of us that were watching back in the 1970s, the B-52 bombers, you know, carpet bombing Vietnamese cities, at the end of it, that's what it was really about. It was about pushing U.S. power and U.S. puppets in that part of the world to take over from the French colonials. But in order to do that, in 71, he basically pressed the button which ended U.S. economic success after the war. Because, I mean, the United States had been such amazingly successful, high standards of living, almost total full employment. You know, they had the best standard of living anywhere on the planet, basically. And they could produce pretty much anything. You know, they were producing all sorts of new innovative ideas. There was the brain drain. Everyone was going to the States into technology jobs over there in Britain. But in 71, to carry on the Vietnam War, Kissinger advised and pushed for the taking the U.S. dollar off the gold standard. And that was really the beginning of the end for the dollar, which is why we are where we are now. They came to rely on the value of the petrodollar, that is to say, oil, propping up the value of the dollar, because it was the only currency used to trade oil. It's becoming much, much less so now. But that was a really important change, I think, in America's ability to actually be economically independent, to fight. I mean, you know, you think about it, the United States has lost the battle with China and many other countries around the world to compete. And that's really why, because they've completely destroyed themselves with this debt, because they got into money printing back in 1971 on the advice and pressure from Kissinger to carry on the Vietnam War.
I'm going to read a few comments. Don't jump in just yet. This from Chris. It's very funny how in Kubrick's Doctor Strange Love, the Russian premier is called Kiss Off. That's from Chris. Hi to G-Man, who says, didn't Kissinger also help set up the petrodollar? Tony's just been talking about that. Thank you for that. Hello to Ian, who says he's looking forward to hearing the Not the BCFM Politics Show tomorrow out of Bristol, where Tony will be discussing this in probably even more depth. That's 5 p.m. thisweek.org.uk for more on that. I'll put a link to it on the podcast, but you know all about it. Anyway, Gaz reckons he was the perfect bad guy. He should have been an actor, Kissinger, the perfect bad guy in any movie. Yet he moved people. Everybody who ever met him, now by everybody, people who were people with a high public profile, who would have met Kissinger over the years, they had nothing but good things to say about the guy, you know, in terms of his personality. Strange that, isn't it?
In a way, it's not so strange, because with his book, Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, you know, as I said, came out in 1957. He showed that he had been thinking ahead of the game. I mean, everyone was wondering, what on earth is this going to these nuclear weapons? What are we going, you know, how are they going to affect the world? The balance of power. Everyone was afraid. You know, obviously these things are incredibly dangerous and powerful. And, you know, I think that's one of the ways he got so much respect, and he managed to sort of infiltrate himself really into the top of the deep state in the United States. But I mean, you can't actually just say, you know, it's all criticism, because that was a very useful thing for him to have done, is to sort of spell out, look, we've got nuclear weapons. Let's just face up to it and understand that, you know, diplomacy is now far more important than it ever was in the past. And that's how he kind of, I think how he made his name. He also, another thing he did, which was really brilliant, actually, was 1972. He started the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks Treaty, because up until then there'd been this crazy arms race going on with the Soviets and the Americans just racing each other to build more hydrogen bombs and neutron bombs and God knows what. And so the SALT Treaty was finally signed in 1979. But that was Kissinger's work. you know, very important job. And, you know, so we've got to give credit where it's due. I mean, he's a very complicated character. Yes, there was, he organized these horrific coups in Indonesia and Chile in 1973, but secretly behind the scenes. I mean, people at the time watching the news would have seen, oh my goodness, there's been a coup. But they wouldn't have known, and they didn't. Nobody knew until the various leaks afterwards that Kissinger had been behind all this.
That's right.
And the same with Chile. When we see a coup today, we are a little bit quicker. I mean, those of us that are paying attention to figure out who's behind the coup. But back in those days, we assumed, oh, it's just the military have decided to take over. No, it was Henry. And the same with the Turkish invasion of Cyprus. That was him.
Giving them the money and the means to do it. Pietro, and others are reminding us of Christopher Hitchens' book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. That's right, came out about 20 odd years ago. He only killed 3 million, says Anne. Thank you, Anne. Yeah, awful man. Before we talk about other matters, because there are things I want to get your opinion on, because there's some huge news this week. Did he say, I think he said it, he referred to older folks as useless eaters and that the population needs to be decreased, did he? Was he one of those?
Oh, well, I've never heard. Look, I mean, you see these kind of things going around. You've got to be able to source them, really. The only reason I use the other quote, which he denies, is because so many other top people were quoting it themselves, credible people and newspaper people at the time. But look, you know, yeah, the other thing is 73, the Yom Kippur War, which, you know, obviously has been very much in people's minds. The 50th anniversary of that, which was when this attack on Gaza started by the Israelis a couple of months ago, that was him as well. He was very much involved in supplying. In fact, what happened was the Israelis asked him for, I think it was something like about $500,000 worth of $500 million worth of arms to replace the arms they'd used in the Yom Kippur War. And of course, there were American troops flew over to help the Israelis at that point too. But Kissinger insisted that they should have at least four times more. And this really annoyed the Arab countries, which led to the arms embargo against the United States in the winter of 73-74. Any of your older listeners will remember having to queue for that. Was Kissinger. He did that, you know, because he was supporting the Israelis far more than they even, you know, asked him for.
And the oil embargo. Yeah, the oil embargo,
It was they called the energy crisis, the oil crisis. We were all queuing for petrol for weeks and months, actually. But 74, really important. Nixon was forced out, right, over Watergate. But if you really start drilling into that, you'll find that Nixon had demanded the FBI files on the JFK assassination. So really important. I mean, you know, this was something that was not going to be allowed to come out. I mean, they're having the Warren Commission and all that sort of stuff. But Nixon didn't believe it, like the rest of us now. And he said, I want to see all the files. And he was demanding this. Well, eventually, suddenly, oh, dear, look, you know, there's a big scandal and Nixon is going to have to come out. He's going to have to leave as president. And he was impeached and booted out. But that was actually what it was really about. And of course, Kissinger was sitting in, you can see pictures of him sort of stood behind Nixon with this little silly smile on his face, you know, where he knows what's going on. And if you're going to dig into this, Mr. Nixon, president or not, you know, we're going to get rid of you. And they did.
Is there a 21st century, is there 2023 version of Henry Kissinger on the world stage? Is there? That we know.
Well, I had a look. I listened. I was crunching my brain cells on this earlier. It's a very difficult question to answer. And I was thinking initially about some of these top Bilderbergers, like somebody like Peter Thiel or Elon Musk, you know, these sort of internationalists that now see themselves as the sort of kingmakers, the kings of the world. And also, of course, with lots of fingers in the media pies, as Kissinger had, with all these favors that were being done for him across the Western mass media. But I think probably actually King Charles is a similar figure. He's extremely, he likes to pretend that he's not really very political, but actually he's making political speeches all the time. He's a big maneuverer when it comes to geopolitical tectonic plates, such as the Middle East, as he's, you know, been very strongly anti-Hamas.
I don't think he said anything, has he, T? I don't think he said very much.
Oh, yeah, in the King's speech, he was extremely against the Palestinians. He said something about that straight away in the King's speech, and he made a speech I think just the day before,
just after the attack happened on Israel, which was absolutely condemning Hamas as terrorists, which they're not. You know, they're a legitimate representation of the Palestinians' right to self-defense, which is their right in international law. So these monikers of, oh, such and such is a terrorist. Well, they may be, but what are they actually representing? I mean, look at the Israelis. The Israelis are hideous terrorists. They've been killing men, women and children, but particularly women and children is the thing that makes it so disgusting. Something like, you know, we hear the official figures around 4,000 or 5,000. Maybe the real figures are up to sort of 30,000, some are saying, because there's so many people whose bodies still haven't been found
under the rubble.
Because you're not allowed to go back and, you know, and even try and excavate your family from the rubble because they're threatening to bomb you and kill you. And there's the Israeli army wandering around.
I don't think I don't think you can use the excuse of self-defense when you've murdered women and children. Now, Hamas did definitely murder some women and children. How they did that is up for debate, and I want to talk to you about Owen Jones in a minute, because as a journalist, and I'm speaking to a fellow journalist, this is very interesting. But when you do, you see, I've always made the case, I never supported the IRA, even though I am a dyed-in-the-wool Irish Republican, but I never had any time for the IRA, because once you start killing taxi drivers, you know, because they're unionists. And when you attack Remembrance Day parades, you become a terrorist, you know. But if you target specifically military installations, I don't like it, but I can make an argument. Hamas did some terrible things. I saw their own videos on October 7th. So for me, yes, Israel's response is disgusting. I despise Israel. I despise the Israeli government, not the Israeli people. But what Hamas did, some of what happened on October 7th was disgraceful. Disgraceful.
All of what Hamas have been doing on the 7th of October, the Israelis have been doing it for decades.
I know, but it doesn't justify it, does it? A knife for a knife makes the whole world blind.
About killing and imprisoning innocent civilians is what Israel's been doing to the Palestinians.
I know they have. But why doesn't Hamas reserve its attacks for Israeli military and Israeli police installations? I don't understand it.
You know, we need also, I'm sure you've been around the articles on the Grey Zone, Max Blumenthal. On there, he's explaining that maybe most of the people that died, the Jews that died on the 7th of October, were actually killed by the IDF, either from helicopter gunships, or there was, you know, there's the guy who was actually, I think it was a woman tank commander saying, well, I shot the first tank rounds into Kibbutz Berry. They were just destroying these kibbutzes, and they didn't really care if the Israeli hostages were killed. So, I mean, I think you've just got to be very careful about using this word terrorist.
Yeah, but so do you, and so does Max Blumenthal. Max Blumenthal needs to be very careful, because what he's doing is he's speculating. And, of course, Max Blumenthal, like myself, I have very little in common with him, but both of us, I would probably, we would find agreement 95% on the Gaza, the Palestine situation, the Palestine question. But it's speculation. And I'm going to say this, like it or lump it. I don't mean you like it or lump it, T. I mean, our listeners can like it or lump it. A broken clock is right twice a day. Israel is not always wrong. Not every single word that comes out of the mouth of the Israeli government is a lie. You know, they're not wrong all the time. You know, this thing about the Israeli Defense Forces killed the people inside Israel on October 7th. To me, it's max of bullshit. I'm not saying that some people didn't die in friendly fire exchange. It happens. I know that. But Hamas went in there and did some terrible things, and they put some shitty videos online. I saw them. The videos they put online.
You're using some peculiar language here. No, what Hamas did is what any organization.
Straightforward language.
The places they went into are places which the Israeli state is illegally occupying. I mean, you know, you might think it's okay for them to do that, and whatever.
I don't think it's okay for them to do that.
To agree on is that Israel is a terrorist state.
I do agree with you.
The people who are running it are ex-terrorists.
Fascists.
The woman Zippy Livni is the daughter of the guy that blew up the King David Hotel. She's the ex-foreign minister of Israel.
She's a nutter, yeah.
This is where you know, you just, I think, have to understand that the Israelis are very, very good at spinning whatever they're doing to make out that the Palestinians have no right to self-defense. Of course, this idea of bombing the whole of Gaza is an absolute war crime. And, you know, it's one of the most disgusting war crimes I think we've
seen
since the end of the Second World War.
I agree with you.
Because it's just so unnecessary.
I agree with you. But I've maintained my entire life, at least the part of my life where I've been conscious, that every life is sacred and sacrosanct, particularly the lives of civilians. And I want people to understand.
What's going to happen at midnight tonight is potentially the Israeli Defense Force is going to start bombing again and killing indiscriminately again. And that's supposed to be, you know, this is argued by the West to be, oh, we can't have a ceasefire. You get the Western press. You know, all of the Anglo-Zionist Empire politicians. I mean, we've had our, you know, even our Bristol MPs, Labour MPs, would not vote for a ceasefire. Now, obviously, even a child, 3 years old, can see a ceasefire is necessary, Richie. And,
yeah.
And Benjamin Netanyahu, he claims to be Jewish. It's obvious that he's not one of God's chosen people. I mean, is he having a laugh?
I agree. This from Patricia. The IDF is respected as defence for Israel, but Hamas defending the Palestinians are labelled as terrorists. I totally get Patricia's point again. Don't interrupt me for 25 seconds because some of our listeners might not know. There isn't a mainstream commercial radio presenter ever who's gone as far as saying some of the things I've said about Israel on radio over the years on commercial radio. I do not believe Israel has any right to exist. Its claimed right to exist are based on two very dubious treaties, the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the following year's Balfour Declaration. The partition of Palestine is completely illegal. What happened after that, the 800,000 Palestinians kicked out by the Stern Gang and Irgun, the murders of 15,000, it's terrible. Israel is an apartheid state. Its government is psychotic. The land belongs to the Palestinians. I totally agree with all of that. And I want people to listen to that. What I cannot stand is I cannot stand groups that purport to defend the rights of people, as Hamas purports to defend the rights of the Palestinians. When civilians are killed, I can't bear it. You know, attack military installations, attack the IDF by all means, but don't kill people and don't parade people's bodies around in pickup trucks and all of that shit, because it makes it very difficult for people like us who totally support the Palestinian cause. It makes it very difficult. Because you can't justify that. You can't justify the IRA blowing up a Remembrance Day parade. You cannot justify blowing up a pub in Guildford or in Birmingham and killing dozens of people playing fucking dominoes. I'm not shouting at you, T. You cannot justify that. That's the thing that gets me. As bad as it is in Gaza, as bad as the blockade is, and I don't know because I've never experienced it, when you kill people, you know, and maybe some of those people were killed in the crossfire, maybe. But Hamas definitely killed women and children, in my opinion, as far as I can see. Look, and that's horrible.
Listen, I mean, there's no question about it. The Israeli Defense Force personnel have testified that this was going on, that they were told to fire into areas. And, you know, if you look at the, for example, that Kibbutz Berry, there are various other, loads of other areas where you can see the houses have been blown to pieces, not by Hamas, by the IDF. And they have this Hannibal doctrine, as I'm sure you know.
Yes.
Where they
better
don't
to be
really
killed than captured.
Care
yeah.
too much about killing hostages. And in fact, we've seen this with many of the hostages that were taken by Hamas. The Israelis have killed them by bombing them. Now, this is why we've had massive demonstrations out on the streets of Tel Aviv. And I would now say that you know, you cannot label Netanyahu's government as a Zionist government anymore, because so many Zionists, either in London, in Washington, all over the world and in Tel Aviv and all over Israel, are now absolutely fed up with Netanyahu, and they're trying to get rid of him. What he represents is this greater Israel bloc, and that is a political far-right bloc, which is based around the 1920 British map of the Palestinian state that the Israelis wanted to start colonizing. Before, by the way, Transjordan had been created in the late 1920s. And this map, the British created in 1920, was used by Smotrich, this far-right nutcase from Israel, earlier this year, in April, I think it was, on one of his podiums. And all of the Arab nations are saying, look, he wants to take over Jordan too. So these are the problem, not the Zionists anymore, because a lot of the Zionists are doing the best job they can to get Netanyahu out.
8,000 children may be dead in Gaza. That sickens me to my stomach. You know, a lot of, we're a different breed, you and me, because we're old school. A lot of people will talk about these things, and maybe I don't have the right to judge, but I don't reckon it impacts on people. I think people have become desensitized to it, and it becomes a talking point. It haunts me, to be honest. I can't bear it, what's going on there. I can't stand it. When I see that guy, Peter Lerner from Harrow, who's a top communicator now for the IDF, lying through his teeth on the BBC and on Sky. It makes me sick to my stomach to see a young girl put a blanket over her dead body. That horrible video we saw 2 weeks ago of the father carrying the boy missing the top of his head. It makes me sick. It is evil. The Israeli government, subsequent governments, consecutive governments, evil beyond belief. I totally agree with that.
The
it's
question
horrible.
Is, what's it about? That's the question. What is really, really going on? Are they mad? A lot of people called Hitler mad. I don't think they are at all. I just think they've got an evil plan, because you've got to understand why would anybody want to turn the Holy Land into hell, into as they've done over the last couple of months? I mean, that's what they've been doing. And it's obviously there's something dark, should we even say occult, satanic about this this government in Israel. And I think it's pretty clear to me that it's the Albert Pike scenario, where he wanted a First World War and a Second World War and a Third World War. This is the Grand Master of the Scottish Rite Freemasons in the 1880s over in the United States. He said, look, we need to create this. You know, he's a deist, basically, and a Luciferian, and he wanted to get rid of the Abrahamic faith. So what he said was the First World War will be, I mean, this is in a nutshell, right, will be used to clear the Ottoman Turks out of the Holy Land, which it did. And Allenby, the British general, had the Battle of Gaza in 1917. At the end of the Battle of Gaza, where he pushed the Turks out into northern Palestine, that was when the Balfour Declaration, at the end of that week, was published in the Times of London.
Yeah.
A year later, in 1918, there was another big battle, which was the Battle of Megiddo in northern Palestine, where Allenby again kicked the Turks out further north, really, and then he went up to Damascus, I think it was, after that. But at the end of that week, guess what happened? They signed an armistice with the Turks, and World War One was finished. So it does rather look as if maybe they were following Pike's plan. So the idea was then, after that, obviously, you know, you had the British Mandate, you had the creation of the Transjordan and these various other countries. You had the beginnings of Jewish migration. You then had the Second World War. And after that, well, of course, there was loads of the Havara Agreement between the Zionists and in 1933,
it's anti-Semitic. It's anti-Semitic to talk about the Havara Agreement. Did you not know that? You're not allowed to talk about that.
According to John Mann, Ken Livingstone mentioned it, and then he was just booted out of the Labour Party, like weaponizing anti-Semitism. That's what they've been doing.
Weaponizing the truth.
So anyway, with the creation of the Israeli state in 1948, and by the way, it was voted for by the United Nations with a bit of help from Nelson Rockefeller and Victor Rothschild. They got the vote through. And so what we're seeing now is the third part of Pike's plan, or the war number three, which is planned to be a kind of pseudo-religious war. The idea with the Zionists, nihilists, which is what Pike calls them, having a massive battle with the Islamic world. And the idea is to discredit these Abrahamic faiths forever, saying, oh, well, look, all these world wars, they're just fighting these wars over religion, and we need to just get rid of these stupid religions and have our own kind of nice pantheistic man-made religion to take over. That was Pike's plan, and it does seem to me as if that's exactly what the Israeli far-right government, the Greater Israel bloc, are planning. Remember, of course, Hitler had this thing, Lebensraum. We don't have enough land.
That's
we need
right.
to steal some land. And this is exactly what it's the Hitlerian plan that that Netanyahu is following. And, you know, with all the Zionists going over from Europe before the Second World War, the ones that were left in Europe, this is the ones that had held the rabbinic tradition, you know, from the Torah, old, very, very old, kind of old school Jews, hundreds of years of learning in there. They were just exterminated, wiped out. So all we're left with is mostly Zionist Jews after World War II.
Craig says, and he makes a good point, could arguments be made for atrocities allegedly committed by the Israelis? Of course, says Craig. However, Hamas also has a track record of horrific persecutions of their own population, and it's often ignored. It is ignored. He's right, Craig. Hamas is nothing to be, you know, to be defended. I don't mean, again, I'm having a go at you, but Hamas is no group of decent revolutionary defenders of the Palestinian people. They're not really. And we know, of course, because the Times of Israel has done a fantastic series of articles, that Bibi Netanyahu has engaged in a policy of propping up and funding Hamas for years, because it meant it made it very difficult then for the Palestinian Authority, right? It made it difficult for a two-state solution to ever really get off the ground. It's murky, it's filthy, everybody is shitty. You know, a friend of mine is not a friend of mine anymore over this, funnily enough. One thing we always agreed on, there are really no good actors in any of this, really. And the people who suffer are the people. The people suffer,
but,
right?
When you're looking at that relationship between Israel and Palestine, one of them is nuclear-armed. Let's not forget to mention the nuclear weapons that the Israelis have got and have threatened to use. In fact, they were there was even a veiled threat to use them against the Russians. There was an academic that was talking about bombing European cities like Paris and Berlin with them. So they obviously do have those nuclear weapons versus this Palestinian state in Gaza with 2.5 million people there with absolutely nothing.
No,
with very
nothing.
Little. And they have very little. And so it's, you know, it's a David and Goliath style situation. And they do have the right to self-defense.
Of course they do. Of course. They're the occupied. I agree with you.
That's why I would say, it's wrong to just label these people as terrorists. They are the Israelis, of course, you know, whatever, 100 times more terror than the Hamas have ever done.
Patricia, who commented earlier on, and I there's lots and lots of comments, but I know Patricia personally. I know she's emotionally invested in this, as I am, and as you obviously are. And she says, more civilians have been killed in Gaza in 2 months, less than 2 months, than 18 months in Ukraine. And I read the New York Times 3 days ago, and an advisor to the Pentagon, whose name escapes me, a well-known advisor, he expressed shock, real shock at what is happening in and what has happened in Gaza. And he compared it to the US Air Force bombing of Iraq and Afghanistan, and he said it was far worse, and he explained why. And I was reading this in the New York Times. It is demonic in the eyes of some people. Of course it's demonic. I mean, how could you do it? How could you do what they've been doing for 2 months, flattening a place, making it uninhabitable? And
what about Gideon? I mean, Gideon Levy is an Israeli journalist who's still got a column in Haaretz.
Yeah, Haaretz, yeah.
Even though he's so critical of the government. He spells it out, absolutely spells it out. He said that there's three reasons why, I'm going to have to make sure I remember them now, three reasons why the Israelis have been indoctrinated, three ways they've been indoctrinated, right from literally from their first school days and by their parents, many of them too, into this idea. First of all, that they are God's chosen people, even though actually, you know, people like Victor Rothschild, who made sure that the Israelis got their state after World War II, was an atheist. He was not even interested in religion. A lot of people who created it, I think this religion is just a kind of veil for them. So first of all, we are the chosen people. Number two, we are victims as well as being the chosen people. But this is a kind of mentality that they grow up with. And finally, most importantly, according to Gideon Levy, it's this idea of dehumanizing Palestinians. So they are less than human. He uses an example of waiting at I don't know if you've heard it, but he is waiting at an ambulance, as an ambulance in front of him with a seriously ill Palestinian is trying to get through the border to the hospital. And he's just sitting in his car, and these Israeli soldiers are just playing cards by the side there. Oh, we always make them wait for at least an hour before we check the ambulance and maybe let them through. And he started shouting at them, obviously these soldiers, and he said, look, what if it was your father in that car? And at that point, they pointed their guns at him, even though he's Jewish, and started screaming and shouting at him because they don't like to hear that. They have dehumanized the Palestinians. These people are exactly the same as they're being treated exactly the same
as the Nazis saw the Jews. Yeah.
The Nazis treated the Slavs, the Gypsies. You are a part of a master race, and in fact, we had a very good discussion on one of my programs a few years ago about this whole idea of master race. Is that what the chosen people, the chosenness of the Jews is? And it was Gilad Atzmon who was saying, well, they're making that comparison, and various other people, you know. So this is where we're at with this, is that there is a very similar mindset in the much of the Israeli population. Being this hatred of Palestinians, as there was with the Nazi sort of the superiority of the SS and people like that. It's a kind of nuclear-armed doomsday cult.
You know, I've said this over the years and I've been criticised for it, but I'll say it again. While the Palestinians get murdered and while their properties get razed to the ground every few years, and now it's worse than ever, the Israelis are enslaved at birth. You said it. I had a big row with Norman Finkelstein last time he was on the programme about 4 years ago. Because I used to get on really well with Norman, but he didn't like, I took on this whole idea. I put it to him that the Israelis are enslaved. They're as much victims in a kind of a perverse way. They are victims as much as the Palestinian people. Because if you do that to children, which goes on in Israel, we know this. If you do that to them, if you poison their minds from their earliest days and tell them that you've got a bunch of rats over the fence over there, and what they want to do is they want to kill you. They want to kill you because you're God's chosen people. That's abuse. You know, that's a very mild way of putting it. It's beyond abuse. So you got victims there. Okay, they don't get bombed to smithereens. They don't have nothing. They're not locked into a concentration camp. But abuse is abuse, and those people are enslaved as well. I want to ask you about this, Tony Gosling. Thisweek.org.uk. It matters not what we think of anybody's politics. You and I have been consistent our entire careers about the right to free speech, the right to an opinion, the right not to be persecuted for it. What is happening to Owen Jones at the moment is shocking. For our listeners who might not know, Owen Jones writes for The Guardian. He's a bit woke, maybe. He's very into gender politics and stuff like that. But he's always been, through his life, I think, a defender of the rights of the people of Palestine. The IDF has embarked on a bit of a campaign to try and convince Western journalists who do support Palestine and have supported the people of Palestine. The IDF has been sharing with them materials, videos and images to say, look, look, look what happened on October 7th. It was really terrible. We have no choice but to do this. And I watched Owen Jones' video. He said, right, the IDF gave me some films. He said it was pretty bad. It was pretty terrible. And I don't condone what Hamas did and all of that. But he said, look, they didn't show me any hard evidence of beheaded babies or women being raped. And they've gone for him. Journalists writing for The Telegraph, Alison Pearson, your man who writes for The Spectator, Brendan O'Neill, everybody's gone for him. They're trying to destroy Owen Jones, Tony. They're trying to finish him, basically.
I think there's a very, very specific reason why this is. And it relates to, I think it was a Mondo Ice cartoon that came out a few weeks ago, which showed two bombs falling down from the sky, both with Israeli the flags on them. One of them is heading towards a woman with a baby, and on it is written, "No mercy." And the other bomb is heading towards a camera crew who's filming the woman with a baby, saying, "No witness." And Owen Jones's last columns is making this exact point. This murder of journalists and the deliberate targeting and assassination of journalists by the Israelis over there. I mean, I was commentating on my show about the killing of just two of the 70 now or so journalists who've been killed by the Israelis. And it's quite clear that they have been deliberately targeted for the obvious reasons, that the same reason as, you know, when we would get out filming demonstrations with video cameras and flogging the footage to the local news, we were being arrested by the police so that we couldn't get that footage onto the news and we couldn't make a living. What they're doing is they're just killing the witnesses off. And this it's despicable in itself. I was reminded very much of the death of Terry Jones at the hands of the coalition when it was in the Iraq invasion. If you remember that, he was the ITV journalist who was in a van with his film crew.
Yeah.
And the Americans and the Brits just blew him up, machine gunned him, and he died. So that he can't obviously witness that. But you see, the message that's sending is, oh, the journalists that you embedded with the forces who are sitting in an armored personnel carrier or in a tank are fine. You know, they're okay. So this is encouraging the big mass media to make sure they don't send journalists in who are not under the supervision of the military. It's a pretty, I mean, we've been doing this, but I mean, the Israelis have been doing this on an unprecedented scale. The number of journalists being killed during this time is way above the scale.
And do you know what else is going on? I mean, that's scurrilous, that's scandalous as it is. But a lovely British doctor announced at a press conference the other day that a lot of surgeons that were trained by British surgeons, they've gone missing as well, that they've been taken out of cars and spirited away somewhere to God knows where.
Owen Jones's piece, anyway, if people want to read it, it's well worth it. I mean, I'm not a big fan of his, you know, but he says, who will shine a light on the atrocities in Gaza if all the journalists are wiped out? That's what the Israelis don't want to hear. That's what hurts them. And so that's what we need to be repeating again and again. And I'll tell you, if you, because I've worked in these main, you know, had done courses to do with being in war zones. I've never actually been in one myself, thank God. Although my colleague Martin Summers spent a year or so in the middle of the Yugoslavian conflict in some really dicey situations. Is that if you know that a journalist has been killed in a certain area, that means no other news networks are going to send journalists in there. So you just have to kill the first one, and then you know that. Of course, you know, how many reports are we seeing live from Gaza? None, hardly at all. There's one guy, I think, or maybe two guys. The BBC have been doing a bit of reporting from there, but hardly anybody else, because they know if they send a journalist in there, that journalist may never come out, because the Israelis have already sent that very clear signal to the insurance companies and to the manufacturers of the flak jackets that, you know, if you send a journalist in here, you're probably not going to see them again. And that's why they're doing this. And that's why they hate so much the truth that Owen Jones is telling them.
You mentioned embedding, of course. I read a lot and did a dissertation on embedding years ago. For listeners who don't know where that came from, the idea originally came out of the Vietnam War. You know, the perpetrators of these atrocities, like Kissinger, as Tony was discussing earlier, and others, they didn't like it very much that middle America, mom and dad were having their dinner, watching the television. They didn't like it that the reality of war was brought home to them by journalists. So the idea to bring the journalists with you, look after them, keep them, you know, where you could keep an eye on them, That basically came out of the Vietnam War. And we saw it, obviously, in the Gulf War, didn't we? We saw the whole embedding thing. Now, we've literally only got a few minutes left, because I did want to mention briefly COP28 and what might come out of that. I know.
God, no.
What might come out of it?
Another one. 2 weeks these things go on.
Blah, 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 says Greta. Yeah.
And so, you know, of course, it's quite the news around it has been quite funny. You know, I've been chuckling listening to it about the big oil deals being done down there, you know. But at the end of the day, this is part of the Armageddonist, accelerationist lunacy that is the climate change obsession. Now, I'm not saying climate change isn't happening. It is. But what's happening is it's, again, a little bit like the anti-Semitism. It's been weaponized. The idea is that we're not allowed to even dig this stuff up ourselves. What are you talking about? You know, there is the idea that man has caused the climate change. Well, I think that may well be, but I still don't think that it's absolutely proven, because the thing that convinces me of that is to see all these people, these scientists over the years, including the editor of The New Scientist, being destroyed, their careers being destroyed, them being destroyed, you know, basically character assassinated.
David Bellamy.
They have a different point of view. This is clear evidence that this is a scam.
David Bellamy.
The thing that makes it even more evident is that King Charles, as he was Prince Charles, has created many of the companies which are doing this carbon trading business, you know, the carbon offset stuff. So he stands to make a fortune out of this. And that was the Panama Papers revealed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, you know, COP is an absolute, well, it's a pantomime, but it's actually like watching the end of the world unfolding. And, of course, that's why I mentioned him as a replacement for Kissinger. It's because he is a massive mover in this self-immolation of the whole of the developed world.
What did you final comment from you. We've only got 90 seconds. I've got loads of comments to read then. Tell me this. When, I think it was the Sunday newspapers, I didn't know this, but I bet you, with your big silly brain on you, I bet you knew this. Did you know that in the north of England, did you know before Sunday, last Sunday, that when people die without any wills, their property goes to the Crown, Mother of God? Did you know that?
Yeah, well, this is Rob Evans. He's done a brilliant job in The Guardian in picking apart the Black Spider letters and all the King Charles stuff. I mean, listen, this guy is a dictator. Did you see Remembrance Sunday?
Yeah.
On Remembrance Sunday, there he is, all smug face in front of the non-remembrance cenotaph, where they forget to remember everything and then they just do it all again.
He marched into, or yeah, sort of marched into the Foreign Office, a massive big door that only seems to open on Remembrance Sunday, straight into the Foreign Office with Sunak and Cameron close behind him. And then the next morning we hear, oh, Cameron has been made Foreign Secretary. Oh, okay. So that guy was totally useless and destroyed Syria and Libya, amongst other things, and who the British public kicked out in the referendum. Oh, we're bringing him back again.
Yeah.
So this is King Charles telling his little supine Goldman Sachs boy Sunak, oh, we want this guy in. And that's who's running the country. I think it's now Charlie.
Tony's on air tomorrow at 5 o'clock, not at the BCFM, not the BCFM Politics Show, Bristol. It's brilliant. It's brilliant every week. I listen every week. You can challenge me if you want. I know exactly what you talk about and who you talk to.
No,
listen, you got 30 seconds. I'm going to, because you never ask me for anything ever, tell us about the Traitors of Arnhem. 30 seconds. Where can they get your books?
Well, actually, what I really want to say is there's a great Times article saying it's not really Charlie. Camilla wears the trousers. and she does. And you can see, for example, with the reshuffle, there are various people that Camilla's friends and relatives were saying, oh, we want this one out. And they were out. So that's the way it's. And this is run through something called the Order of the Garter, which Tony Blair is now and Camilla are now all in there. Now the Queen's died. This is King Charles's little clique that runs the Traitors of Arnhem. Well, it's a book about the end game of World War II and how the
Winston Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton, he was doing deals in 1944 with Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, and how Bormann was secretly brought out by commandos trained in Hailing Island to the UK and then managed to set up 750 companies over in South America after the war, which is the Fourth Reich we're dealing with today.
And it's brilliant. I've got my copy over there on my shelf with my books. Tony, thanks for today, pal. Enjoy the rest of the week and the weekend. And tomorrow, 5 o'clock, UK time in Bristol, not at the BCFM Politics Show, thisweek.org.uk. Also check out bilderberg.org. Until next time, T, thank you.
God bless, and God bless the listeners. Thank you, Richie.
Cheers, buddy. Always good to have you on. Tony Gosling. Nobody's been coming on my shows longer than T.